Well, Horace, I read news recently that Toyota announced in 2016 they're planning to create cars to capture images and GPS data, of course, highly detailed location data of roads. Is it possible for the incumbents, and of course there's other news that we'll talk about, is it possible for the incumbents to play the new game? I mean, it's 2016 after all.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this is, I think, at the crux of the dilemma of the car industry is whether change is going to come from within or from without. And this is what we talk about in terms of turnovers. And at the bottom of the theory of disruption is this idea that there's a turnover occurring, right? And that the incumbent, which has been presumably in business for a long time, is displaced or is
goes away.
It just becomes
fades into the past, right?
But here's the thing about the auto industry, which is why we spend so much time with it, is that the premise that incumbents are somehow going to disappear or result in less relevance is colored, when you look at it historically, is that there hasn't been a disappearance. I mean, the Ford. So first, let's look back in history. The car maker that initially marketed cars was Daimler-Benz, and they're still around. The biggest maker of cars that, in terms of popularizing the production system and hence the low cost car, was Ford, and they're still around. And so they began around the turn of the 20th century. And then General Motors that came and also innovated dramatically in terms of production and in terms of model changeover, they're still around. Then we had Volkswagen, which really took off after the war, that, you know, they added capacity, if you will, globally by their Beetle. You know, they're still around. And then we had the entry of the Japanese in the 70s and mostly 80s, and that was Toyota and Nissan and four or five others, Mitsubishi, Honda, and so on, and they're still around. And then, so we're seeing is kind of like a layer, a cake that's being growing in tall, in its height. And if you, I have a graph in front of me that shows production, and it just looks like, and it's actually not by manufacturer but by countries. You have the United States, and on top of that, you have the Europeans. Oh, actually, you have Canada and the U.S. kind of together, and Mexico is now adding quite a bit of capacity.
Sure.
And you're seeing these layers getting added on top, but not so much about the layers that are at the bottom shrinking. So it's not that, you know, a disruption is occurring in the sense that the incumbents are going away. Rather, we're adding new incumbents. The largest layer right now is China, which has only been a 10-year phenomenon. I mean, they were barely on the radar in 2000, and now, you know, from 1 million units up to looks like at least 20 million units today out of a global production of 90. So there's a huge amount of production in China, mostly invisible outside China because they don't really export. They're producing for internal use only. And that's the curious thing about the market, is that you can have a successful entry, as had Toyota, as had General Motors, as had Volkswagen, as had Korea and China, without the incumbents feeling that they're being crushed. What happens is generally is that they do give up some market share, but they tend to survive and they tend to kind of do okay. So what curious, the question is, when you throw technology at the problem or at the question or at the at the method. Is that going to change this particular dynamic of stacking more layers onto the cake, where the new layers are coming from technology companies, or are we going to see structural change at the bottom of the layers? And that's where I think there's still a lot of head scratching going on. I've actually put a lot of effort in the last few days in trying to model this market and trying to figure out what will happen for the foreseeable or even longer term future. I would say I'm modeling to 2040, but we can get to that in a minute. So I want to make sure we answer the question: is an entry by Toyota going, or the embracing of certain technologies, sensors, maps, and data, is that really going to sustain them, or is that really only a boondoggle, an effort to
distraction?
Yeah, someone at Tesla, I watched a video from a Tesla executive who had since left. I guess he must have been the founder. And he remarked how the budgets that were spent, the budget money for EVs as of a few years ago at the larger companies was being spent by marketing dollars and maybe a few R&D dollars, but not the largest piece of the pie, which was money coming in from the sales, which is usually regional money. And that regional money just does not get allocated to new efforts. And so there's this question about, you know, when you hear about initiatives, all self-driving and data and entertainment, and are they really just coming out of somebody's PR budget? Or is this structurally significant? I don't want to get into kind of the weeds of how companies allocate resources, which
sort of like Cayman versus SUV production at Porsche, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, so the data point I throw in is not just SUVs at Porsche, but now Lamborghini is going to make an SUV,
right,
which is well known. And the production data, so they're going to double their production because of that. So if you thought that Lamborghini is a sports car company, it's time to rethink that, because Lamborghini will be an SUV company.
Like
probably within a year, they're going to sell more SUVs than they will
sports
cars. And so is the case with Porsche today. So I'm sure, you know, after Lamborghini, Ferrari will follow as well. And we'll just have these
large boxes.
These cow cars, I call
getting
them.
Ready for the Winnebagos, the autonomous Winnebagos horse.
Yeah. Yes. But anyway, we're kind of
we digress.
Digressing. So the thing is that that's where I'm trying to figure out what is the right hook into this. What is the right angle for analysis? Because we can come at it from multiple angles, right? We can look at it from what is the RPV of the firm? So resources, processes, and values or priorities. So what are the priorities of the firm, of the incumbent? What are the priorities of the entrant? And we can do top down, we can do bottom up, we can look at it from demand, or we can look at it from supply. So it's not as simple as saying, you know, whenever I tweet or comment on cars, lots of people throw back a huge amount of data and information and suggesting that is somehow causal to my question. So this morning, for example, I've been tweeting about my forecasting methodology and so on. I'm trying to project the market, and everyone is suggesting, well, here's a data point for you. You know, Tesla owners don't go back to gas cars. Okay, well, that may be, but it doesn't. It may be that EVs are one-way street. People, once they go to EV, they don't go back. But does that make EVs more likely to accelerate up the adoption curve? So here's where I began down this road, and there was a report a couple of days ago, a week ago maybe, from OPEC, where they, and this was tweeted by Mark Andreessen, he retweeted or commented on and so on, and the OPEC guys or gals, I don't know who, suggested by 2040. Which is again within my time frame of analysis. By 2040, 94% of cars on the roads would still be powered by gasoline. or diesel.
Variants, right. Petrol. Yeah.
It could be hybrid, though, within that. Mm-hmm. But basically, they were saying that electric vehicles would be 6% by 2040. So that's a bit of ways away. And a lot of people are scoffing at this. But I took it upon myself to try to build a model which either made that plausible or implausible. So by looking at what would you need to believe in order to see a 6% penetration of electric vehicles by 2040. And so a couple of things we have to assess. First of all, this is not a measurement of units sold in a particular year. This is a measurement of cars on the road. And, you know, cars that are built today will still be on the road probably 14, 15 years from now. The average car is living longer than ever. Where I think 14 years is the average globally. And I have cars that are older, much older than that. So it's not crazy to think that 14 is a reasonable number there. But then you ask, well, would a hybrid or an EV car last longer? And then again, that would factor into our calculation. So the amount produced and then the description of the length of time that that product would still be in use. So the next question, okay, let's assume it's 14 years for gas. I made a further assumption to say that a hybrid would be, let's say, 16 years, a little bit longer lived, and that an EV car would be 18 years. And I think actually EVs could last a lot longer because they have almost no moving parts, but the batteries might need replacing. So actually, you know, I would not be surprised to see a Tesla last 20 years, given that, you know, there's four or five moving parts in there. You know, the wheels, then the
brakes and
the brakes and the motor.
Right.
And that's it. You know, the steering parts, suspension parts, and so on. But when you add it all up, it's a fraction.
Small, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's much less heat, and there's much almost no vibration from the you know, vibration and heat are a lot of the material failures.
Sure.
That you there's also no chemicals that might again cause some kind of corrosion or leakage and needing expensive repair. So there's a lot of things about an electric car which make it seem like it's going to last longer. So let's assume 18 years there. Now, given all that, how many cars are on the road today? So that we have to carve out of that market of cars and then project that market to 2040, where there's several estimates about both of these numbers. Cars in the market today or on the road today, registered cars globally, is about 1.2 billion. We crossed over 1 billion as early as 2010. So even if that growth isn't phenomenal, it is a steady 2%. Also bearing in mind that out of the whole China's 1.2 billion people, there's only 100 million cars. So if the Chinese were to consume cars the way Americans do, we would be looking at another billion cars just in China alone, although that's not likely to happen. But even so, most projections going out to 2040, 2050, I think there's a projection that 2050 there'd be 2.5 billion cars. So I'm projecting at 2040 that there'd be about 2 to 2.2 billion. Now, 2.2 billion cars. So to think about that number, and by the way, okay, just so we are addressing a lot of the caveats here, a lot of the complaints there will be, oh, sure, you know, as efficiencies are gained, as automation is gained, some car consumption will decline as markets age and mature, as the U.S. and others are actually declining in numbers of miles, driven and so on. There's a lot of factors, but let's not forget the vast bulk of this growth from 1.2 to 2 billion will come in the emerging markets. This is India and China alone are going to consume a huge number of that growth. Even if the Western markets decline, there's still a huge amount of growth coming from these other markets. So let's not forget the U.S. is 4% of the world in terms of population. So let's assume for a moment that 2.2 billion is the market for all the cars on the road in 2040. Now, if you were to say, okay, let's target EVs of that to be 6%, that's still an installed base of, I haven't even calculated it here, but it would be, is it 6% times, here my actual estimate is 2.28 billion. So that comes out to 13, is this right? 13 million, no, 130 million, I think. My formatting is wrong. It's computing as a percent. Yeah, 136 million. 136 million cars would have to be electric and on the road by 2040. Now, how many electric cars are on the road today? Well, we do have a rough number for that because we have some production data. And some EV in use data. And I currently estimate there's about 1.1 million EVs in use in the world today. So there were about production numbers, for example, for 2015 are about 430,000. So tiny. Where does that leave us?
It's tiny. So are you implying that there, I think you're implying two things. One is that thus far, this is a phony war, right? This is we're arguing, we're debating over peanuts. I mean, nothing, the scraps in the market. And that second, the initiatives that we see, you know, Toyota, no dummies. I mean, obviously, a very successful company is just now getting serious about collecting their own data versus cutting a deal. Well, maybe there aren't any players to cut deals with other than TomTom anymore. So is this much ado about nothing for a while, Horace?
Well, you know, this is why it's a multidimensional puzzle.
Yes.
We have one puzzle is that data, you know, so let's say it's a puzzle of theories. One theory is that data is everything, the future data. Data is gold. Data is the oil of the future. Data is everything.
Yes.
And there's that argument. And then there's the argument that the car makers would turn to just say, well, production is king. I mean, all this talk about changing the world, but who's going to make the car? And where are those cars going to get made? Where's the employee who's going to make it? And so on. And all the production-led thinking. And then there's, like I just brought up, the longevity question. Well, 2040 may seem a long time from now, but if you sequentially say a car lives 18 years, that's not too many cars away from now, right? So this is like two ownership cycles away. And then there's indeed, there might be, that car will only be in the possession of the first owner for a couple of years. But let's not forget that doesn't mean the car disappears. It gets sold on. And unless we get into a throwaway mentality that a car gets actually literally scrapped after 5-6 years, which is, by the way, very much the practice in Japan, where the rules on old cars are so onerous in terms of inspection and in terms of requirements for maintenance that most people do scrap cars after 4 or 5 years, or they get sold off into overseas markets, which is why India, well, not India, but so much, but let's say Africa. Is filled, mm-hmm. filled with old Japanese cars. Even Russia, if you look at the very, very eastern part of Russia, the area near the Pacific, it's awash in Japanese cars. And so there's this question about longevity. There's this question about where are these cars coming from. And then you have behavioral changes. You have demographic changes. You have ownership, shared ownership questions. You have Uber and the notions regarding what do you hire a car for? And do you hire to serve you or do you hire it to own it, which are completely different things. So a lot of these we've talked about in the past, but the thing I'd like to point out is that if you were to do a numerical analysis, which is very hard to measure those other things, it's very hard to measure sentiment, it's very hard to measure individual markets, and sum them all up. So I might know a few anecdotes about Japan, a few anecdotes about Europe, but I know nothing about Indonesia, and I know nothing about, or very little about, India. And these are huge markets. Indonesia is as big as the United States, and India is four times the United States. So you ask yourself, well, what do I know about Africa, which is a billion people? What do I know about South America, which is nearly a billion people? And you say to yourself, well, I could not do a bottom-up analysis where I had some assumptions that I could calculate, which is why the production logic is the one that lends itself best to a numerical analysis, which is what I've been doing. And so when you look at it, it humbles you because the numbers are so, so massive. Actually, one of the side effects of this was to answer also the sanity question regarding Apple, because if Apple, as I said before, if Apple were to enter the market, I don't think they'd be interested in being a Tesla. Tesla is far too small, far too slow to actually make any impact in the sense of being meaningful, meaningfully changing the market. They may change perception, but there's 0.0% impact in terms of their changing of
meaning.
Of
it's not a meaningful contribution, Horace. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's not meaningful in a numerical sense. So this is the question about an Apple entry. Is that I don't think Apple is interested, and this may sound radical, I don't think they're interested in making a perception change. I think they're interested in making a material change in the market, meaning that they want to actually move large number of people into owning an Apple car. And thus, through that transition of ownership, that those people might end up impacting the world in a positive way. But, you know, selling 50,000 cars isn't going to do that. So the question is, when I was asked about this in the past, I would answer, by the fact that they claim that they want to make a meaningful impact, I'm going to make the assumption that meaningfulness equals 1 million cars a year. And I make that assumption because by selling 1 million cars a year, you're almost, although maybe already not anymore, but a few years ago, you would have almost been in the top 10 car makers in the world. Today, it's probably the hurdle is a bit higher because the whole market is growing. So 1 million cars is by, you know, so here's what I did. I took some assumptions. I said, let's say that the year one, and if by year one, I'm going to say 2019, and if Apple makes 50,000 cars in year one, which, by the way, was production for Tesla in the, what is it, sixth year of production? I don't know exactly. But it was just 50,000 units, I think, this year. But let's say Apple's super ambitious and they want to come out of the gate in 2019 with as many cars as Tesla is making today, which is be 50,000 cars. Ambitious, I know. But let's say they have the resources and the motivation to do this. Now, how many could they do in the second year? What would be their growth rate? Well, I'm going to put another assumption on the table, which is similar to the assumptions I was making with the phone business back when they got started, which was what they would be doubling production on a yearly basis. So that means 100,000 in year two, which would be year 2020. Then I would double it again to 200,000 units by year 2021. Then double it, or not quite, maybe about 80% increase on the third year to, in my case, I estimated about 360,000. So that's 80% growth into 2022. Okay, now, because it's unlikely you can preserve 100% growth, especially in something as big as the car. And now, basic question, are we meaningful yet at 380,000 or 360,000? No. So how many years would it take for them to get to 1 million units? Well, by my calculation, again, a bunch of assumptions put together, I give them about 6 years to reach 1 million units a year. And that would put them out to 2024. So 2024 to 2025, Apple would be, in my opinion, making a meaningful impact. Now, I'm assuming they're all electric. And then we have another set of numbers which are trying to see how fast the electric market would grow. So here's the question. What would be global market share for Apple at the moment of being meaningful? at that moment when they reached a million units. Well, again, because we have many moving parts. Right. The whole market is growing. The EV market is growing within that market. But I'm guessing it's about 1% by 2024. So here's a statement. If Steve Jobs were still alive, he would be stomping on the stage in 2018 and saying, we will make, like, sort of like a Kennedy speech, you know, by the end of this decade, we will have 1% of the car market. He could say something like that, or by the middle of the 2020s, he could have 1% of the car market. And that, by the way, would be extremely aggressive, because like we said, if the bogey is Tesla, they would be overrunning Tesla, like leaving it in way behind to get to that number. Tesla, by the way, has a target by 2020 of 500,000 cars a year. And this is their target, which I think they can achieve, but it's a 10x increase from where they are now. So 500,000 cars by 2020, and Apple would be already on the same schedule, would be at 100,000, but they would quickly overtake them, and by 2024, presumably they would be at a million units and 1% share. Now, how far beyond that can they go? This is where it gets really, really hard. Let's not forget that the top three automakers today are all about at the same number of units, which is about 10 million units a year. So it ranges from 9 to 11, and they're between Toyota, Volkswagen, and General Motors. Mm-hmm. Those three that right now are jostling for 1, 2, and 3 slots. And then you have a significant drop to number 4. And so that is the market today. Now, those, assuming those grow organically, which is about the same rate as the whole market, which is about 2 to 2.5% a year. Again, barring unforeseen things, like the biggest thing that took a huge chunk out of the market was the credit crunch. And that meant there was a huge, huge dip that year, 2009, but it's been recovered since, so that we've had a recovery. But in any case, we're looking at this overall growth picture. So anyway, I've done a bunch of...
Yeah. So you're saying that growth, I mean, growth covers lots of sins, right? So the current positioning is... It may pay off for some, but it may just be a marketing initiative, as you identify. And most of the business will just continue as it is, right?
Well, again, if history is any guide, and it may not be a guide, but on the other hand, you've got to make these things. So even if you may suggest, because these are bits, these are atoms, these are not bits. And so... production matters. Scale matters. We were able to see very, very rapid growth in the phone business because production methods were able to be created to deliver billions of phones a year, potentially. We have the factory capacity to deliver that. That was not available 10 years ago, but it is available now. Now, could we see the same behavior there, but at the same time, will there be demand for cars to electric cars to ramp at the same rate? So I'll just say this: I've been trying to be as aggressive as I can be to deliver a very, very steep growth curve for electric vehicles, and this balancing all the constraints in terms of longevity of vehicles, replacement rates, capacity available, and so on. And I'm looking, for example, the best, I think, outcome would be that all the production capacity in the world would be switched from pure internal combustion to a mix of hybrid and electric by 2040. And if that's your target, so assuming that there would be no pure gas-only vehicles made by 2040, that production may not trickle into ownership in the same way you might imagine. So, for example, the overall penetration of hybrids and electrics will be below 50% by 2040. And EVs alone will be merely 14%. Now, remember, OPEC said 6.
Right.
But I'm saying if I'm extremely aggressive, if I'm extremely bold and throwing away a lot of the constraints that might be present, I'm still suggesting by 2040 that the EV base could be as high as 14.5%, of which, by the way, Apple would be producing by then 7.7 million cars a year and gaining as a world market share 4.8%. So I'm actually saying by 2040, Apple could conceivably, as an entrant, and let's not say it's just Apple, but you know, it could be someone else, but it could be someone else coming in from outside, and they could gain 5% of the global market, producing 7.7 billion, million electric vehicles. And yet, even that happens, the rate of change in the whole industry in terms of replacing all the cars that are on the roads with something electric will be, I'm afraid, beyond our lifespans. You know, I don't think I'll live to see that. It'll be beyond my foreseeable lifespan. But it is happening, and it will happen within a century of starting. But it's not clear to me that this can happen any faster than that.
So 14% by 2040.
14% EVs in the installed base, which, by the way, corresponds to, it's not a small number, it corresponds to over 334 million cars in use, which is an increase, again, from a base of today's 1 million. So it would be 330 times more than we have today. It's an extraordinarily large number, but it is a 14% of the whole pie. And by the way, I'm being even more aggressive in the hybrid market, because there I'm assuming there's almost 600 million hybrid cars in use. So right now, and I gave a 1-hour talk about this on another podcast that hasn't shipped yet, but I talked about how, in fact, hybrids have not gone the way we had expected. And in the U.S., there's still only 2.3% of the market, and Toyota is still 70 to 80% of that market. And the only reason, therefore, I mean, as Toyota hybrids go, so does hybrid in general go, which is a problem indicative of the fact that it's not a modular technology. So for my model even to come true...
Right, it's actually more complex, right? Because you've got the traditional
modular
infrastructure.
And by the way, that's one thing that EVs have that potentially have the hound, which is that it's easier to take off-the-shelf parts and put together an electric vehicle.
Yeah, Shenzhen exists for EVs.
The challenges with hybrids are many. One, you've got to re-engineer a lot more than adding an electric motor. You've got to have new types of braking for regen. You've got to have electric accessories as opposed to the ones that are currently belt-driven. You have to have, for example, air conditioning with its own motor. There's a lot of things that need to be re-engineered about the whole vehicle and the start-stop technology, the transmission technology, so that if you're an automaker today who's been on the sidelines and you're asked, hey, let's just assume that you're forced to do this because the government tells you you have to reduce your emissions by 50%. If you're mandated on that level, and who do you turn to? You turn to your suppliers and you ask them, can you deliver to me an electric motor? And then or can you deliver to me a packaged hybrid motor or hybrid solution? And there's no supplier in the world today that can turn, you can turn to and say, give me this solution I can drop in so I can have it in 2 years in my car.
Well, Tesla's trying to position themselves for that, right, with their Gigafactory. They're seemingly trying to build infrastructure.
I don't know. I mean, they're presumably going to manufacture batteries, but it's one thing. That is a one subsystem. So you have to think about, what does it take to engineer an electric car? Now, as you know, I'm experimenting it on my own by doing an EV conversion. Yes. It's actually fairly straightforward to drop a motor, put an electric motor, plug it straight into the transmission, and then put in a lot of batteries around it. But you do affect the center of gravity. You do affect the space available for other things in the car. You do affect the balance and performance and many other factors. So it's not quite so simple. When you look at a car like the Chevy Volt, the positioning of the batteries, they had to put them in a tunnel between the seats. In the rear, so you have this question about where do you put this mass, this heavy mass. One thing that Tesla is clever about is the fact that they put the batteries in a very thin layer right at the bottom of the car, which is actually the cleverest thing to do, because you put it at the lowest point, but you also don't, you create a flat floor, so you don't have these problems of bulging and weight distribution and all these other things. But in doing that, you're also using a certain type of battery, which is not necessarily the most efficient thing you can do. There has 6,000 individual, essentially slightly bigger than a AAA battery. And there's a lot of packaging materials involved in making 6,000 of these versus, let's say, you know, a dozen larger batteries, as you might expect. Let me put it this way. The difference is between a max battery solution versus an average PC. When you look at a Mac and you look at the packaging of a MacBook, they've had to have these scalloped designed batteries that are very thin, actually shaped in a way that actually is non-irregular, I would say, have that battery pack in there. Or the same question about an iPad or an iPad Pro is how much battery is inside of it versus pulling off-the-shelf components and packaging thick batteries, which is what most PCs would have gone with. So this idea of re-engineering the battery pack, I think Tesla went about it in a more off-the-shelf way, but if automakers were to push into questions of design, questions of packaging, questions of manufacturability, they might go about it differently. I'm not saying one way is better, but I'm just suggesting that there's trade-offs all the time. So anyway, I cannot answer today the question of modularization of hybrid and electric. That is going to be an engineering question. But the faster one of these modularizes, the faster they're going to be able to take over the market. I think that it comes down to that. If you want to get that curve as steep as possible, modularize.
You're talking about the adoption curve for us.
Yeah, the adoption curve. If you want to save the world, let's be right. Blunt. If you want to save the Mr.
Stick
polar
it to OPEC,
bear,
yeah.
If you want a polar bear to survive, you've got to modularize the solution so that manufacturers, which currently have capacity and distribution, can take it into use and push the product out. The faster they can take it into use, the faster that curve is going to go. And although incumbents could just say, well, look, we're just so impatient, you guys, we're going to elbow you aside, it doesn't come to me as an obvious answer because, again, they have to go through the learning curve, they have to build capacity, they have to fight for distribution, they have to fight with regulators. There's a lot of things. Now, I'm not saying that won't happen. It's just it will not happen wholesale. It will not happen across the board. It will not happen so that a Google, Tesla, and Apple trifecta will somehow push out Volkswagen, Toyota and General Motors. What will happen is there'll be a niche. And as I said, Apple carving out a 5% niche of the global market will make everybody who owns Apple shares today phenomenally wealthy. But it doesn't mean that they'll actually change the carbon footprint all that much. What has to happen is Apple has to happen and Nissan, Mitsubishi, General Motors, and all the others have to reach on the shelf, pull down a hybrid system or pull down an electric system and plug it into the same models and sell them through the same dealers. As I had to be watching television over this holiday period, and I say, oh my God, there were nothing but car ads on TV. And I just said to myself, why are people doing this?
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal reported the other day that M&A activity for car dealers in the U.S. is at a record. It tells you something.
Well, car dealers, I mean, every single ad, they were getting more and more bizarre. And I would say abstract is not a sufficient adjective because they were CGI renderings of cars doing impossible things, people saying absolutely silly things. And at the end, it was just like, you know, go and get to your, you know, a Mazda dealer, your Toyota dealer, your Ford dealer to take advantage of special holiday offers. And it had nothing to do with a vehicle. It's like you just see a flash of a vehicle and then a happy family, and then cut to the dealer. But the thing is, as silly as this all sounds, you know, it just feeds this market, and it just goes on and on and on. And unless, again, we can go back to the question of, can we change this behavior? Can we change the behavior of users who seem to be hypnotized by this idea that I shall have to go visit my dealer over the holidays to buy a new car and present the key to my wife or my husband with a decorative bow, and that is a behavior.
And my rebate check, yes.
And so it's crazy, but you know, when you look at the numbers and you ask yourself, what makes the biggest difference? Let me put it another way. This is another thing that came out of looking at the data. If you obsess over things like hybrid technology and EV technology and maps technology and entertainment technology and all these other things that you think are going to make an impact, and you measure and you slave over the growth and you do all these things, and then you look at 2008 and 2009, and you look at 2008 and 2009, and what happened was that money froze up. There wasn't available capital to finance these impulse purchases that people have for cars. There wasn't enough capital, and there's somehow the system just kind of, it was a financial thing, right? But it was like the gears stopped turning in the financial system. And as a result, the car market just plunged. I would say the impact of hybrid, let's say, is 2%. The impact of a credit crisis is 20%.
At least. I think it was
40%. The market was just completely in the free fall. We had parking lots and huge amounts of land allocated globally to storing cars that had come out of manufacturing plants that could not be sold. And these were just lined up as far as the eye could see. They couldn't turn off production, remember.
No.
So what did they do? They kept it going, but no cars would get sold. So they just kind of piled them up. And so the government came to the rescue and said, we'll scrap old cars and give you $2,000.
Right.
And so they destroyed a lot of old cars, thus creating some demand, alleviating some of that crisis. And that occurred in the UK and in the United States.
US, right.
And so, but this is what boggles the mind, is that when you look at these forces acting on this industry, and you say, well, let's cut off credit, and suddenly the demand evaporates, or what? I mean, you want to make a change in the world? Some people say, well, increase gasoline taxes, tax carbon, which is, you know, possibly that may come to, between now and 2040, that may come to fruition. But if you think the world is going to change because the data and you in the car is going to change, I'd say change the interest rates by 2% and you're going to have 10 times the effect. So that's why I still argue, you know, I'm still puzzled by this market and trying to figure out how can we possibly analyze, and it's such an important market in terms of the impact on the environment, and the fact that, you know, as you know, all the leaders in the world flew by burning a lot of fuel to Paris to discuss the burning of fuel. And those leaders made some pledges. And how are we going to meet those pledges? I think as far as governments are concerned, they might as well, you know, the easiest way to do that is through tax policy. If you crank up the taxes on cars, guess what? People are going to keep them longer. They're going to stop visiting their dealer on the day before Christmas or whatever. And maybe there won't be as many cars purchased. Maybe they'll just, you know, they'll crash the market doing that. And as a result, maybe out of the ashes will emerge companies which don't have the same production methods. And so we go back and forth through this question. What's the real causality of change?
So for those existing players and sizable firms, is the message, is the reality that they will become Verizon and cut deals with Google, right? Which is what they did to make Droid. Ford announced, or at least it's leaked, that Ford is doing a deal with Google for software and manufacturing of self-driving cars. You know, what that means, if they're building more than a handful of units, you know, who knows? But
we see all of these deals being made and talk of Google becoming the operating system of the automobile. And Ford is one more player supposedly who has been fooled into becoming a slave to Google. And, you know, we hear.
How do you really feel, Horace?
There's all this talk, but I'm not convinced that this is material, meaning that I don't think yet that this will affect this enormity that we're facing in terms of transportation, because, again, you have to know a bit about the way these things work. Ford does make lots and lots of agreements, but I think the agreements they have with their floor mat supplier is probably much more meaningful than the deal they're having with Google today.
Today, yes.
You know, it's the chasm between behavior of buyers and behaviors of suppliers, behaviors of governments and behavior of infrastructures versus what we clearly anticipate to be inevitable, which is that data will become the most important asset in a car. The chasm, however, is so great today, it's very hard to imagine how this inevitability will occur. And so this is what I always describe as going from impossible to inevitable. And right now it seems like we are facing impossibility. And there's only one variable in between impossible and inevitable, and that's called the speed of adoption. And that number that tells you how quickly we go up the curve is going to be determined by a bunch of these factors. And I think fundamentally to me, the most important one is whether there's going to be modularity, which again is somewhat, and then that's the zigging, and then the zagging is what Apple does, is like they're going to actually do be the integrated player. To me, the excitement of Apple is that they'll actually probably create the best product. They'll probably create the most excitement, and maybe, in fact, be the most meaningful in terms of actually capturing the most profits. But as we saw in the phone business, all the iPhones in the world, of which there are a considerable number, at least half a billion, they're still not all the phones in the world. And so, question again, how much, when, by what means? Those are still open questions. I hope I'm answering something you're asking. I don't know.
I think you're answering that it's still early. It's even earlier than early, yeah.
And that's the purpose of my exercise with numbers, is that I'm trying to see, make some statements like, what is OPEC crazy to suggest 6% of cars? Well, they're actually not crazy, because I calculated aggressively could be 14%, but you'd have to ignore a lot of friction to get there. So maybe mine is at a little bit at the high end, maybe theirs is a little bit at the low end, but there's that question of sanity. The next question, again, I'm trying to answer is, can an entrant make a meaningful impact? Can an entrant like Apple really... You know, if you make it as aggressive as saying I'm going to go from zero cars a year to 5% of the market in 20 years, is that crazy? It turns out that it's possible if you make these assumptions. And the next question is, what is the compound annual growth rate in EVs and in hybrids that will get us out of the dependency 100% on 100% gasoline or
carbon fuel
or carbon fuels? I mean, even though hybrid is still going to be carbon, the efficiency of it is such that we're going to be reducing the impact on the world. But the thing, when you look at that and you say, okay, can you sustain 17 to 20% compound annual growth rates for 30 years? in a market that's only growing 2%. This is the sort of questions so that allow you to sit back and wonder.
Right. So one question I would have after this discussion is, given the role that economic conditions play in the overall market, which is highly material, obviously, is it important if you're Apple looking at this space to say, perhaps like they're doing with iPhones, that we need to control more of that experience, right? So we're not going to sell it. We're going to lease it, or we're going to rent it, or however that plays out. Is that important to their success, as you say, over 20 years, to ride those shocks out? So it's no longer a retail purchase. They're just going to route around the whole retail game, the end of the year, the, you know, the balloons and all that, and come up with the same thing they've done with the iPhone, which is, this is the price, and off you go. The carriers obviously do deals, but what is the business model going to be critical for them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if, by the way, the balloons are the thing that sells cars in Europe or Asia, or, but the Americans have been doing car sales longer than anybody else. So you know, they've gotten it to such an art that it seems like the world has a lot of learning. But a lot of those things are again factors of the regional conditions, the laws, the taxes, the franchise rights. And I suspect this is where the biggest innovation is going to come, is in this buying and owning experiences. And also, again, if they're targeting ownership, and if ownership becomes less interesting, and we can move toward a more of a car sharing or car hiring business as opposed to car owning business, then we might see some change in the dynamics. I don't have crystal ball. I think Apple could innovate a lot in terms of this, and we've talked about this before as well. You know, putting new form of car retail,
exactly
reducing the options list, so that you have really. So this is where it's going to be interesting. We have one Apple Watch with a bunch of variations. We have one iPhone with two sizes and a bunch of variations. But still, when you look at the portfolio strategy of Apple, it's very, very narrow. Whereas, and if you look at all the options and everything available for car makers, the number in the millions, and that's not an exaggeration. What they can do is really tighten up the iconic nature. And this came up also during a discussion about brand value on Twitter. I was having a lot of the brands are out there diluting themselves. So you don't really know what a Porsche means. You don't know what a BMW means. Is BMW seriously all about driving when they have
minivans, yeah.
Minivans and SUVs and front wheel drive cars.
Right.
As every car maker is out there working as hard as they can to dilute their business proposition or their brand value, Apple could step in and say, you won't even think about, you know, imagine a conversation. Right now, if somebody looks at an Apple Watch, they're going to say, oh, is that an Apple Watch? Remember when Macs were called Apples, or when iPhones were called, you know, well, iPhone always was called an iPhone. But this idea that if it's got an Apple logo on it, it's kind of iconic. I would think that there's an exciting opportunity there to re-iconify cars. This used to be true in the car business because the Volkswagen was an icon. The Mini was an icon. The Fiat Cinquecento was an icon. The Model T was an icon. The 57 Chevy was an icon. The Toyota Corolla was an icon. But they're
Mustang,
all gone.
They're all gone. Yeah,
all gone.
Very few.
They've been completely mushed into this undifferentiated mess. And sometimes there's nostalgic sort of reenactments of these
for things. The baby boomers, yeah.
Yeah, for sort of treating cars like accessories and handbags. But imagine the opportunity, though, for Apple to come in and say, this is the Apple car. it is not Apple Car
Edition 5 or GT
IX. Right, you know, it's not the 4 series or the 3 series Apple Car. It'll be just one. It won't last. Don't, you know, I'm not naive. I think it'll broaden out in about 5-6 years, because you've got to do that to appeal to a larger audience. But that's what happened with Tesla. It's like, you could say Tesla Model S, but everybody said, oh, you have a Tesla. And that meant one thing, you had a Tesla. There was no, you know, there's no...
The Lotus chassis is long forgotten, I think.
Yes. Yeah. That was nothing. but the thing is, how you do that is when you is the wonderful thing about entry. When you are entering, you're able to make that splash with an iconic product, and people will remember it as being the Apple Car. And so when they do that, you have several degrees of freedom as far as marketing is concerned. Pricing becomes simpler, retail becomes simpler, explaining the product becomes simpler, choosing things. Everything allows the buyer to suddenly associate that product with the problem they have in their lives. And that product then solves that thing. This is the classic job to be done. When you have product that is undifferentiated, then product that is completely diluted, and brand value that's non-existent, you cannot make this association. It makes it difficult for the buyer to understand why they need to make that purchase. So there is that greatness about it. And then once you put these together and you put the retail strategy, I think they'll have a wonderful ramp, which coupled with better manufacturing, hopefully techniques, will get them into the point where they'll have, you know, a million cars a year in a five or 6 years. And then the question then becomes, that is that formative stage, that is that stage where you've gained a foothold, when you gain the credibility and the value of the brand. And afterwards, you just refine, which is also something Apple does very well now. And during that refinement period, they'll do all those things which people say they shouldn't be doing because they succeeded by the other way. So they'll broaden the portfolio, they'll extend the product, they'll extend distribution, they'll do all kinds of deals. And at that point, that will seem like, oh, yeah, it's no longer the sweetness of the first few years, but that means they're going to go from 1 million to 7 million. And you know, that's part of growing up. And at some point, you know, they have to ask themselves, you know, middle-aged or not, you know, do you want to go in another direction? And to some ways, you know, this is what happened to the German companies. The German, all the Mercedes, BMW, Audis, they all went through that period in which they were known for being great on one dimension. And you know, the ultimate driving machine, engineered like no other car in the world, and I don't know what Audi's thing was. Maybe it was all-wheel drive. But whatever the thing is that they had a hook on, they were happy for a while. And being German, they were you know, satisfied with being good at that one thing. But you know, through financialization, they decided to suddenly have 70 models a piece. Right. So and then what? And now you're in
marginal cost is 2% and marginal revenue is 15 or whatever. Yeah. It is. Yeah.
Now they're in this crisis where it seems like, yeah, they've got all the growth, but they have none of the brand anymore. Mm-hmm. And somebody can just walk all over them.
Right.
Brand.
Yeah. So it sounds like we have fodder for future discussions, particularly business model and the ever-present modularity, but it's always
great. Modularity is the story I want to tell in more detail. I started on it. It's going to become a big part of my life in the next year because I'm writing a book about it. But the thing, I took modularity and I asked the question about hybrids. Why didn't hybrids go the way we had hoped they would go? Now, we might still, if my modeling were to come to be reality, it still has to go through that transition. If it fails to do so, my theory suggests that it'll be over for hybrid. As far as, you know, making an impact, they either will be overrun by electric, which will modularize much more quickly, or they just won't make an impact beyond the Prius, which you know, because they're just for whatever reason, Toyota is not going to license the solution in a way, and even if they were to license it, no one is going to pick it up and run with it. because it's a Toyota thing. I don't know. Who knows? But that's a really exciting topic we can talk about next time.
Yeah, great. All right. Always a pleasure, Horace.
And likewise.